We continue coverage from the 2011 Cattle Industry Convention here in Denver, and it's always a lot of fun to have the opportunity to sit down with Greg Dowd, the chief economist of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Also very enjoyable to sit with several of our colleagues, including Don Wick of the Red River Radio Network and Stuart Dunn with AgriPulse, the three of us talking with Greg Dowd about a variety of issues. We start with a question from Don Wick.
Let's talk some economics if we can. Obviously, we are looking at that high corn market. Give me an idea what the impact that's going to be having on us.
Well, I think right now as we look at the cattle business, and we've had a situation where we were seeing some profitability across all sectors. Now we're looking at the crush in the cattle business, which is buying feeder cattle, buying corn, and selling live cattle, and how all that works. And the key indicator of all that is looking at live cattle out in deferred futures positions, April 2011 and beyond. And what you see when you get out there, and in fact, one of the interesting discussions that we had kind of internally here the other day was April 2012 live cattle futures at $118, 100 weight. And so would you hedge that? And the answer is probably not. These markets are too volatile. There could still potentially be some upside there. Managing that risk in what is going to be just enormous volatility, I think, this year and probably beyond on the grain side, you know, all we're going to hear about is this battle for acreage from here until we see corn coming out of the ground, and understandably so. And I think one of the messages that we were just talking about this last night, Phil Tseng and I and Brett Stewart of Cattle Facts, when we were going on the TV show, if you look at what's going on in Tunisia and Egypt right now, what's really at the root of that is food prices. This is the discussion about, you know, being able to feed people in a sustainable manner and being a reliable and consistent supply of food. These markets are signaling to U.S. agriculture that we've got to crank up the volume here a little bit. If you look at deferred futures contracts, that's exactly what it's telling you. So this, as long as the value of the dollar stays where it is, global demand in China, et cetera, is where it is, this could be a real golden era for us here in agriculture.
Smallest cattle herd, though, in over 50 years. How does that play? In other words, how do you get your guys to hold heifers back enough to be able to rebuild the herd for 2 or 3 years down the road?
Smallest herd, we're still running cows into the slaughter plant. We're not retaining heifers, and feeder cattle prices are through the roof. Some of the numbers I've heard just in the last few days here are amazing. And yet, we're having conversations in the hallway. You're retaining heifers, you're going to do this? Well, I'm not quite sure about all that yet. We're going to have to get sure here pretty quickly. I really worries me at the rate we're butchering cows. And I personally think this is a time that we need to sit down with the banker. And I tell you, I had a really interesting conversation with my brother-in-law, the banker, here just the other day about understanding the fact that $1,000 cow, bred cow, is now potentially worth $1,200, $1,300, $1,400, $1,500. What's the bank examiner going to say about all that? Do people understand that in this dynamic now, in all of agriculture, whether you're in the grain business or the livestock business, it is going to take a whole lot more money just to do what we've always done?
And what does that tell you, people, with the kind of feeder cattle market there is right now, and yet they're still sending heifers and cows to slaughter?
Well, I think it tells you that we haven't gotten the message across that this isn't a flash in the pan, that this is a little more of this is a new paradigm in terms of price and where we're going to be. These are not my words, but in the people that I listen to, and it'd be interesting to see what the Cattle Facts guys say here this week, but I don't see a situation where we're going back below $100 live cattle anytime soon, unless we have some sort of international demand dynamic that you can't foresee. When you have $100 oil and $6.50 corn and everything you have here, we've elevated this thing to a new paradigm. And so to answer your question, are we going to rebuild the herd? You've got to send the price signal to these guys to rebuild it, and it's going to have to be there for a while. And I think that's just going to take some time. But I think once that kicks in, I think we'll get that. It's just a matter of the timing here and trying to help people get their head around what's going on around us. That's what I'm trying to say.
Do we have enough young guys to, you know, step into that? We've got a lot of older guys that want to mess with it.
We have a lot of older guys that don't want to calve heifers. I understand that. We do have, in my opinion, probably something of a labor issue in the cow-calf industry today and dealing with that dynamic. But, hey, it's about price, too. If you send that signal that there's going to be some real opportunity and value in doing that, I mean, and I can tell you personally, you know, in September, October, $1,200 or $1,300 bred heifer today is worth $1,500 or $1,600. Something's happened here in very short order that people need to get their head around that's sending a signal that there's real value here. Get with the program.
Can we switch gears over to some trade issues? Obviously, beef exports have been getting us back into the 2003 level. When do you see things like Korea popping, those kind of things, to help us even move further?
We came up with a pretty good quote last night that trade is hot again in Washington. Suddenly, out of nowhere after this election, trade is in vogue again on Capitol Hill. I think it's a real good chance that we're going to get this Korean Free Trade Agreement pulled through Congress here in short order in the first half of this year. The question is really whether they'll pull Colombia and Peru along with it or how all that's going to work. Darcy Vetter, Deputy Undersecretary, will be at International Markets this week. One of the things she's going to talk about is in the next 30 to 45 days, there's going to be an enormous push in Geneva to work on the WTO negotiations. This has really kind of come out of nowhere. It's really kind of surprising. But a lot of it has to do with the announcement late last year out of Japan regarding their interest in being a part of this Trans-Pacific partnership that the U.S. is working on in, as part of ASEAN and Southeast Asia. They've said, look, we have to reform our ag sector in Japan. It's holding our economy back. Moving forward to do that, what's that translate into for U.S. agriculture? The potential, the real potential to have some sort of free trade agreement with Japan. And that is a really important thing that we have to follow. So we've got big things going on the trade arena. We've got WTO, Japan, and TPP. Russia's going to try to finally finish up and get them done to become a member of the WTO. We've got all the dynamics going on with China. We've got the Mexican trucking issue resolved that's real helpful that hopefully will allow us to work on some beef market access issues that we've still got to resolve in Mexico. Really disappointed that our guys, U.S. government, did a yeoman's job the first 10 days of Japan of January in China to get U.S. beef back into China. Really disappointed we didn't get that done. Hopefully we're going to keep working on it. We're going to keep working on Japan. This TPP thing gives us an opportunity to really press that with them. But despite all of those issues, we're going to sell, in 2010, we probably sold a record, all-time record, beef and beef variety meats of $4 billion. And we still probably got $1 billion or $1.5 billion to go. So that if you look right now at the prices of chucks and rounds, trim, drop credit, and so those are all the different components that make up that carcass, we're running red hot. And in fact, the drop credit, I think, is up against all-time record high. The one place we're struggling on that carcass is sell the steaks and the middle meats domestically. And I think that's what people in agriculture, I want to emphasize strongly. One of the hottest economies in the world last year and continuing is Korea. China's hot. In fact, in Asia, Australia, they're raising interest rates. They're talking about figuring out ways to cool their economies down. It is a completely opposite of what's going on here in the United States economically. That's what's driving these commodity prices.
I was asked rhetorically this morning in one of the sessions about how much impact things like the FMD situation in South Korea potentially have on our cattle market, on our profitability. You know, what things like that, what are they? How do they matter?
Well, it's not rhetorical. There is a real impact there. In fact, you've seen Korea drop to zero their tariff on imported pork for certain cuts, Canada and the U.S., et cetera. Again, if you look at what's going on in Egypt, Tunisia, food security. All of a sudden we've got this very quick dynamic shift of how do we prevent stuff and protect our domestic industries that are, you know, a little dicey, especially in Asia and the livestock industry, etc., to how do we secure a reliable and consistent supply of food? That's what's going on in Korea right now. They're realizing we've got to make sure that we can feed our people. That is absolutely the first topic of conversation anytime you talk to China. That is something that they're totally focused on, as they should be. And especially when you watch this dynamic in the Middle East, that's what fired this up and started this to begin with. It was about food. And so we're seeing a different situation here in terms of trade and tariffs and ability to sell our products. It's a really hot, new, emerging trend. We've got to work as an industry and as a government and working with governments to governments around the world. We've got to do a better job of talking to each other so we can get this done and do business.
Greg, why didn't China get done in early January? How close was it, and what is the remaining sticking point, as you understand it,
or sticking points?
Well, there were sticking points. I think that in terms of a lot of these sanitary and phytosanitary issues, they moved the ball a long way. And we really hadn't sat down and talked to them about these things in 5 or 6 years. And so I don't know that we're really close, but I think we moved this ball an enormously long way down the field. In football, Super Bowl week, I'd say we're in the red zone here. And hopefully we can have a chance to circle back and get this thing done maybe in the next 6, 8, 9 months. We'll have to see.
Jim Miller is gone. Do you have any concern that there will be a vacuum created by his departure and make it a little more difficult to get back to where we were in this negotiation with the Chinese?
I've known Jim Miller for a long time. When he worked for the Wheat Growers, I worked for U.S. Wheat. I've known Jim a long time. Tremendous loss to the Department of Agriculture to have him go back to the Hill. Of course, he's going to be involved in the Farm Bill process, so you really haven't lost him. Who we get to replace him inside USDA is a huge, huge thing for us in these kinds of topics. That is a critically key position. What you probably didn't know is we've seen a lot of movement over at USTR in the Ag Division as well. We've got several slots open there, too. So we're kind of in a state of flux right now in terms of people and resources in our government to work on this stuff, and that's a challenge for us. Our government has to have the people and the resources to help us work on these issues, and they're hard, and it takes a lot of tough slogging, as you can see, to get these things done.
Economics of GPSA. We know that Chief Economist Glauber is going to go ahead and do an analysis. What do you expect him to come up with? How long as well?
You know, I haven't had a talk with Joe about this year, but that's a critical thing, that we have to have a well-done analysis of this regulation that absolutely should have been done in the beginning. How USDA reacts to the comments, what they do in terms of this cost-benefit analysis in the light of this new Obama executive order on cost-benefit analysis. If you read that closely, though, there are some really funky criteria that he's put in this executive order. So that's the – I don't know. I don't know the answer to your question. You're asking tough questions today. we're going to have to – we're going to be watching that really, really closely. Another issue that we're going to talk about a lot at our Live Cattle Marketing Committee. In fact, we're going to devote most of it to the Eastern Livestock bankruptcy. And I think for everyone to listen to that discussion from some of the best people that we could find to articulate the complexity, the enormous complexity of what happened here and what it involved. But we're not going to rehash what happened. In talking to our NCBA leadership and wanting to evolve in terms of our policy discussion is, what do we need to do as an industry to prevent this from happening in the future? And that's what this discussion is going to be about, and from some of the best people that I know in this business. I really think that's going to be one of the key interesting things that you listen to at this convention.
Was GPSA asleep at the switch and letting $130 million in bad checks go? And if so, are they awake now?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. What I can tell you is from the conversations and the meetings that I've been involved with, the complexity of these transactions and the complexity of what was going on is really amazing. It's far beyond what even I could have imagined it was. There are enormous legal implications in terms of the types of transactions that were involved, when transfer of title and ownership is conveyed, depending on what the transaction is. This is going to be a legal mess for a long time. The question is really, okay, that's for the lawyers to sort out. What do we need to do to help prevent this in the future. One of the key things that we're going to have is I've got a good banker guy that I know. And I asked him, I said, can you come in here and talk about what the banking industry can step up and bring to the table in terms of electronic banking, 21st century banking, so we're not floating checks 5, 7, 15 days around here that you know, again, we all know what the float is in agriculture. How can we squeeze that to keep this thing from getting out of hand on us?
Wire the money before you take possession of the cattle.
Well, these are the discussions. And, in fact, anecdotally, I'm aware of in the auction market community, Livestock Marketing Association guys that I talk to from time to time just out in the country, the local auction markets themselves have said, look, you some of these guys that were out there floating quite a bit, they've really clamped down on it in terms of, you know, we do have an ability to do electronic banking and do just what you're talking about here is in terms of when the money's moving, when the cattle are moving, and when to do transfers. Those are the kinds of things is, you know, you can increase bonds and you can have trust and all these kinds of things. But the frank fact of the matter is those only come into play after you've had a wreck. Mm-hmm. What you've got to do is prevent the wreck in the first place.
One more. And I don't know all the details on it, but Iowa pork producers apparently have put forth or are going to put forth a resolution at Pork Forum. A corn contingency plan. Don, you probably know more about it than I do, but trying to protect enough corn supply for the livestock industry. I know it's sort of that sort of supply arrangement would seemingly go against the grain of the cattlemen, but these are certainly unusual times. What would be your thoughts about this type of an arrangement?
Well, I'm an old grain analyst guy and an old ag policy guy, and you know, if you're a K-State Barry Flinchbaugh taught economist like I am, you know, government held stocks, the old concept of the farmer owned reserve, that's just an anathema. We are not going back to that. Period. That is not a solution for any of this kind of stuff. However, I will say, the issue for us in the livestock industry is absolute in terms of the subsidies that the ethanol industry gets versus the livestock industry is, you know, we can all make this work until you get down to that last 100 million bushels of corn. And the difference in the marginal cost because of the subsidy in the ethanol industry, and there's an economic term there that you have to talk slower to help you understand, versus the livestock industry, you know, what's a marginal cost here? All right, he's talking about all this crazy stuff. The point is, when you get down to that really tight equation, the ethanol industry can just flat take it away from us. And that's the issue that you'd have to address. Me personally, and this is not NCBA, I probably would be more akin to some sort of counter-cyclical subsidy approach on the ethanol side versus some sort of grain storage, grain, you know, stockpile program.
Chief Economist of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Greg Dowd, visiting with us today here at the 2011 Cattle Industry Convention in Denver. On the Oklahoma Farm Report, I'm Ron Hayes.